Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the News Hour tonight...
Their brutal ordeal is over, and they're free.
High-profile Americans held in Russia are released as part of the biggest East-West prisoner swap since the Cold War. Emergency crews struggle to contain rapidly spreading wildfires burning through large swaths of the western U.S. And former President Donald Trump doubles down on the remarks he made about Vice President Kamala Harris at a convention for black journalists. Welcome to the News Hour. The waiting, the worrying, and the dreadful wondering are over tonight for three Americans who were jailed in Russia and their families. Journalists Evan Gerskovich, Alsu Kermasheva, and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan are heading home tonight after an extraordinary deal struck among the U.S., its allies, and the Russian government. A fourth person, a U.S. green card holder, Vladimir Karamurza, was also released. Nick Schifrin starts our coverage.
In 80 years of U.S.-Russia and U.S.-Soviet spy swaps, today's was the most complex. Two dozen people on one Ankara, Turkey tarmac, Russian dissidents, convicted Russian spies, and detained Americans who will be coming home and spoke to their family members in the Oval Office on a day President Biden called historic diplomacy.
This is an incredible relief for all the family members gathered here. It's a relief to the friends and colleagues all across the country who've been praying for this day for a long time.
Among those released, 32-year-old Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich, the first journalist since the Cold War sentenced in a Russian court for spying.
So I've got a medical condition that prohibits this.
Former American Marine Paul Whelan, detained by Russia 6 years ago. Russian-American Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty correspondent Alsu Kermasheva, sentenced to 6.5 years for spreading false information. They posed for a photo with U.S. officials as they flew home. Also released, American resident and Russian-British activist Vladimir Karamurza.
This, you know, personal accountability may well be the only thing that will make them think twice.
He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and pro-democracy activist who lobbied Congress to create the Magnitsky Act, the U.S.'s most well-known human rights sanctions. He was twice poisoned, but kept returning to Russia to try and create the democratic future he envisioned, as he told me back in 2016.
We believe in the rule of law, we believe in human rights, we believe that Russia should enjoy the same democratic institutions that the rest of Europe enjoys.
To get them out, the U.S. worked with Germany, Slovenia, Norway, and Poland that held Russian intelligence agents convicted of crimes, who are now handed back to Russia. Most notably, Vadim Krasikov, who murdered a Russian dissident in a German playground. President Vladimir Putin lauded his work to Tucker Carlson.
That person, due to patriotic sentiments, eliminated a bandit in one of the European capitals.
Slovenia is releasing Russian sleeper agents Artem Dulcev and Anna Dulceva, who posed as Argentinians. The administration says their part of today's deal was finally secured in a phone call between President Biden and Slovenian Prime Minister Robert Golob on July 21st, just hours before President Biden withdrew from the presidential race. The U.S. is releasing what a senior administration official says are three Russian intelligence officials, each convicted by U.S. courts for cybercrimes, hacking, or sanctions evasion.
It is difficult to send back a convicted criminal to secure the release of an innocent American. And yet, sometimes the choice is between doing that and consigning that person basically to live out their days in prison in a hostile foreign country.
A U.S. official tells PBS NewsHour the Central Intelligence Agency tried to secure earlier versions of this deal. In January 2023, the Slovenian sleeper agents for Whelan. In March 2023, the Slovenian sleeper agents and two other Russian agents for Whelan and Gerskovich. Each was rejected by Russian intelligence, which each time demanded Krasikov. Germany's willingness to send Krasikov began as an attempt to try and release former opposition leader Alexei Navalny. That deal was initially agreed to by President Biden and Chancellor Olaf Scholz in early February. But before Navalny's name could be formally offered to Russia, Navalny died in a Russian penal colony. U.S. officials say they negotiated for months, including a letter from Biden to Scholz, and Germany finally agreed to release Krasikov in return for some of Navalny's former allies in Russian detention, including Lilia Chanyasheva and Senia Fadiva. Russia is also releasing well-known Russian human rights defender Oleg Orlov and political prisoners Sasha Skoshelenko and Ilya Yashin, jailed for criticizing the war in Ukraine, all of whom get new lives in Germany.
They stood up for democracy and human rights. Their own leaders threw them in prison. The United States helped secure their release as well.
But not all Americans got out. Army Staff Sergeant Gordon Black, who's been sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison for theft, will remain in Russian detention, as will American teacher Mark Fogel, convicted and sentenced to 14 years in prison in 2022. His mother, Malfine, met with former President Donald Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, the same day of his failed assassination attempt. As for those released, Putin welcomed the Russian spies and their families home. And the American families felt relief. They will soon see their loved ones for the first time in years. And Miriam, also Kermisheva's younger daughter, will celebrate her 13th birthday.
Now she gets to celebrate with her mom. That's what this is all about. Families able to be together again, like they should have been all along.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
John Finer is President Biden's Deputy National Security Advisor, and I spoke with him about the prisoner swap moments ago. John Finer, welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All told, this was among the most complex prisoner swaps undertaken since the Cold War. The deal was in the works for the last 2 years, as I understand it, and ultimately came together in the last 2 weeks. What were the key inflection points? How did this all happen?
Look, I think there are a few key aspects of this deal that really speak to the approach that our administration and President Biden have taken to foreign policy since we got here. One is diplomacy. We have said from the very beginning diplomacy would be the hallmark of our foreign policy, and that includes diplomacy at the level of the president, who made a call to a fellow head of state, the prime minister of Slovenia, 1 hour before telling the country and the world that he was no longer going to be running in this year's election to try to free up one more aspect of this deal that was ultimately successful. It's that sort of face-to-face and person-to-person diplomacy that's at the core of our policy. Second is allies and partners. The president has said his worldview was predicated on rebuilding, revitalizing America's alliances, and you saw a half dozen allies come together today with different aspects of this deal, which ultimately led to get it done. And the third is execution. As you said, this was highly complex. It involved a wide range of countries, complicated logistics, all coming together on the same day, and it was executed without a hitch. And as a result of that, a large number of people who would otherwise be held captive are going to be coming home, including three Americans and one legal permanent resident of the United States.
A question about the timing. Why now? Why did Vladimir Putin view this deal as being in his best interest?
Well, I'm the last person who's going to speak to the mindset of Vladimir Putin. That would be a question better placed to others. But one of the things that you realize, having worked now on a number of these deals, even though this one was the most complex, is that they sort of move on their own speed. There are long, very agonizing sometimes periods in which it feels like not a lot is getting done. You continue to beat your head against it, continue to try to be creative, come up with new solutions, problem solve, have conversations, and then ultimately things can end up moving much faster than anyone anticipates. And that's what happened here. We wish we could have done this sooner. Ultimately, we got it done, we believe, in a timely fashion that has led people to now be home spending time with their families before too much longer. And we're quite happy about that.
To what degree does this signal any sort of breakthrough of tensions between the U.S. and Russia? And might any of this successful diplomacy be put to use in helping bring an end to Russia's war in Ukraine?
To be honest, I would caution anybody against drawing too many broader conclusions about the U.S.-Russia relationship based on this deal. That is not the course we're on, what you just described. We are obviously in a very difficult place, completely on opposite sides of the conflict in Ukraine, and I don't see that changing anytime soon unless Russia makes a significant set of changes to its approach and its worldview, and we don't anticipate that. What we had here was a target of opportunity, an opportunity to get some people home who otherwise would be continue to be held in a just unconscionable situation. We took that opportunity. But otherwise, we are continuing with our approach, certainly to the Ukraine war and to our broader approach to the world on its current course and speed.
While this nightmare is certainly over for those released, there were other Americans, as you well know, who were left out of this exchange, namely Mark Fogel, an American sentenced to 14 years of hard labor in Russia, and a U.S.-Russian citizen, Ksenia Karolina, who's facing charges of treason for allegedly donating $51 to a Ukrainian charity in the U.S. What is the administration doing to secure their release at this point?
There continue to be a number of Americans held under very difficult circumstances, including the two Americans you just mentioned in Russia, including Americans in Syria and Afghanistan and other places around the world. And this administration has made an enormous commitment from before the time we came into this office, from the transition to the Biden-Harris administration, to do what we could to get these people home. I think the president has now an extraordinary track record of doing just that. We're going to continue to work on those cases and all cases of Americans held who shouldn't be until the end of this administration.
Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks again.
Now let's get some additional perspective on the prisoner swap. Nick Schifrin has that. Nick?
Jeff, to discuss the larger implications of today's events, we turn to Andrew Weiss. He's a former State Department official who served in the George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations and is now the Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks very much, Andrew Weiss. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
To the NewsHour. As we just showed a few minutes ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin, at the end of Pride and Time, welcomed home all these Russian spies and their families on a big red carpet, big flowers. What message is he sending?
So Vladimir Putin goes to great lengths to wrap himself in the valor of the Russian security establishment. But all of that covers up a pretty unpleasant and embarrassing fact, which is that Russian spies have been arrested all over the world or caught red-handed doing bad stuff, including the hitman in the Berlin case, Vadim
Krasikov. Right.
So, you know, what Vladimir Putin is doing by putting on such a big show is covering up, frankly, for the continued underperformance of his security establishment and acting like they're big heroes. They're screw-ups. They're not heroes. Hmm.
As I reported earlier, the U.S. Offered two different trades before today, for Whelan by himself and then Whelan for Evan Gershkovich, including those two Russian so-called illegal sleeper agents that had been caught in Slovenia. But both were rejected, and the message that the U.S. got was, call us back when we have Krasikov. So why is Krasikov so important to Putin?
So there's indications that they know each other personally. The Wall Street Journal has a wonderful long piece that appeared sometime today that says they potentially worked together back when Vladimir Putin was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg in the 1990s. So this is a career Russian intelligence operative who's presumably conducted a variety of assassinations and targeted killings in various parts of the world, including in Moscow. And who claims to have gone to shooting ranges and done other things with Vladimir Putin personally. So there seems to be a connection between the two men, the two men rather. And you saw when he came down the jetway today at the airport of Moscow, Vladimir Putin hugged him.
And you and I have talked multiple times about how the different parts of the national security apparatus in Russia often fight each other. Could there also be a dispute within the intelligence agencies inside of Russia over who to release? And would the FSB, Putin being a former KGB colonel, would the FSB win that fight?
So Russia has a sprawling national security apparatus, which is big by design. It's intended to kind of avoid power consolidating in any corner so that Vladimir Putin can kind of divide and rule. But what we've seen, rather than, you know, the Russian security establishment backing away from confrontation with the West, is leaning in. And so we've seen reports of the Russian intelligence services trying to assassinate the CEO of a senior German defense manufacturer. We've seen them conduct sabotage operations. When Vladimir Putin says he's at war with the West, I think we need to take him at his word.
Why would Putin agree to this deal now, 3 months before the U.S. election, instead of waiting?
Vladimir Putin is a cold-blooded operator who is tactical and who believes in being transactional. So for him to get what he thinks is a pretty good deal, for ages they've been pushing to get the hitman in the Berlin case released. This is a person who is serving a life sentence for conducting a murder, a targeted killing in broad daylight. So for them, this is a good deal. And if you look at the other Russians who are coming out of detention, these are people who the Russians wanted back, who were intelligence operatives that have been rolled up in Poland and Norway and in Slovenia. as well as people conducted in U.S. courts. But what is, you know, all these debates about a deal come down to are the numbers, and the counting game is really complicated. So U.S. officials today are at pains to say we're getting 16 people out and the Russians are getting 8 back. So it you know, it's not an apples to apples comparison.
And yet Putin did not release other Americans, as Jeff was just highlighting, Mark Fogel included. Why might he withhold some of them?
They're bargaining chips. So there are other Russians that they want back. There are people that the Russians will continue to take into detention. Any American who's foolish enough to go to visit Russia, even for family reasons, is at risk. President Biden today made a point of that in saying the underlying message of today's grid news is also that people need to steer clear of travel to dangerous destinations like Russia.
And quickly, in the moments we have left, you've had an extensive career in government. How complicated would it have been to coordinate all the European countries and all the U.S. agencies and Russian intelligence to get this deal?
I'm glad you brought that up. That's what's truly unprecedented about today's news. It's a multidimensional problem. It wasn't just negotiated between the United States and Russia. The German role was absolutely critical because, as you've pointed out, that was the key demand from the Russian side. So without the German support, this deal would not have come together. And then you had lesser roles played by our allies.
Andrew Weiss, thanks very much. Jeff, back to you.
Well, thank you both. And Nick, as you mentioned, one of the Americans not released today is teacher Mark Fogel, who was sentenced to 14 years in a Russian penal colony back in 2022. He was arrested in 2021 at a Moscow airport for carrying medically prescribed marijuana. Earlier this evening, before I spoke with the Deputy National Security Advisor, Mark Fogel's sister, Anne, joined us from her Montana home. Anne Fogel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's really important that I tell Mark's story.
While some families are rejoicing today as they've been reunited with their loved ones, your family still has to wait. How are you doing? How are you holding up?
It's been a heart-wrenching 36 hours. I spoke with Mark yesterday morning on the phone, and he, when I realized that he was still in Rybinsk and everyone else had been pulled out of their penal colonies, it was my heart really sank. But it's really hard to give up hope. And for the entire day, I roller coastered around thinking that, you know, Rybinsk is about 4.5 hours from Moscow, and I thought that maybe they would be driving him down. It was just really hard to let it go.
When you spoke with him, what did he say? What did he tell you? How is he doing?
He was kind of in the dark. He knew that something was going on, and then he saw a little bit of news about Paul. You know, they're constantly playing the television and news stations in the penal colony that he's in, and so he knew something was going on, but he doesn't speak Russian, so he wasn't exactly sure. And he called, and I didn't want to. I know this is crushing him. So I didn't want to tell him what I knew. But we, at that point in time, we were calling our senators and calling the ambassadors that we've been in touch with, and we were trying to get something activated for him. And so it was a crazy day of phones and messaging and emailing. It's all for naught.
The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, said today that the administration is working to secure your brother's release from Russia. Have you heard anything from the administration?
No, we've never heard from the administration. I did talk to my sister-in-law, and I did talk to Jake Sullivan about 2 years ago. But Mark has never been prioritized. You know, he was convicted under the same code as Brittany Griner, but he was never designated as wrongfully detained. And we don't have the NBA behind us, and we don't have the Wall Street Journal behind us. So it's been very difficult for us to get our man out.
Your mother, your 95-year-old mother, filed a lawsuit in June against the U.S. State Department over its failure to declare Mark Fogel as wrongfully detained. Why do you think he hasn't received that designation, and how has it complicated efforts, in your view, to secure his release?
I don't think he's been designated because I don't think he's important enough. As I said, we just don't have the notoriety, the celebrity status. And believe me, the worst part of this process is being pitted against other Americans. I don't want that. No one wants that. Mark doesn't want that.
When we started our conversation, you said you wanted to get your brother's story out. What do you want folks to know about your brother, Mark?
I want you to know that Mark has had an outsized impact on the world, essentially because he's taught internationally for so many years. He has thousands of students that he has taught, and he is, there's not a Hall of Fame for teaching, but he is the best of the best. And you have one of his students in your newsroom as we speak. He has students all over the world writing to him, praying for him, making movies about him. We need justice. He needs to come home. He needs to be with his family. His wife and sons need him. And this is absolutely unfair that they did not bring him home with the greatest historic prisoner swap since the World War. I wish I could be more steady, perhaps, in saying these things, but I feel very wronged for Mark. And he needs to come home, and the Biden administration has nothing to lose. They should have brought him home.
Ann Fogel, our thoughts are with you, your family, and your brother, Mark. Thanks again for your time this evening. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Concerns about a growing conflict in the Middle East start our day's other headlines. That's after Israel's military confirmed an airstrike last month had killed the leader of Hamas's military wing, Mohammed Def. Also today, Iran's supreme leader attended the funeral in Tehran for another Hamas leader, Ismail Haniyeh, who was killed in an attack this week. Israel has not claimed responsibility. While in Beirut, mourners paid their respects for Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr, who was killed in an Israeli strike in Lebanon's capital on Tuesday. Addressing the crowd, Hezbollah's leader threatened retaliation, saying the conflict had entered a new phase. For his part, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his country is ready for any response.
Israel is highly prepared for any scenario, both defensively and offensively. We will exact a very heavy price for any act of aggression against us from any arena.
In Tel Aviv, Israelis took to the streets to mark 300 days since the October 7th attack and called for an immediate release of hostages still being held in Gaza. The U.S. Air Force has concluded that a deadly Osprey crash off the coast of Japan last year was caused by a, quote, catastrophic failure in a gearbox. The investigation also found that the pilot ignored warnings to land the aircraft. The crash killed 8 service members and led to a months-long grounding of all military Ospreys. It was one of several Osprey crashes in recent years that killed 20 service members overall. A New York appeals court has rejected Donald Trump's attempt to have the gag order in his hush money case lifted. A panel found that the judge in the trial, Juan Merchan, was right to extend parts of the order until Mr. Trump is sentenced in September. Separately, Mr. Trump's defense team has asked that Merchan be recused from the case for a third time. In a court filing, they cited an alleged conflict involving the judge's daughter and her ties to Vice President Kamala Harris, who is now likely to be Mr. Trump's opponent in the November election. Senate Republicans today blocked legislation that would have expanded the child tax credit for low-income families and extend some corporate tax breaks. In doing so, they torpedoed a bipartisan $79 billion tax bill that the House had overwhelmingly approved. Republicans are betting that they can push through a more conservative tax bill next year if they win control of Congress and the White House. The U.S. Department of Transportation proposed a rule today that would ban airlines from charging parents to sit with their children. Under the proposal, children 13 years or younger must be allowed to sit with their parent or guardian for free. If adjacent seats aren't available when booking, families can opt for a full refund or wait for a seat to open up. And if one doesn't, they can rebook for free. The Biden administration says the rule could save a family of four up to $200 in seat fees. On Wall Street today, stocks dropped after recent data sparked worries of an economic slowdown. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 500 points, or more than 1%. The NASDAQ lost 400 points, falling back toward the 17,000-point level. The S&P 500 also ended sharply lower on the day. And spoiler alert, we have more results from the Paris Olympics. The all-around final for women's gymnastics was packed with stellar performances, but in the end, gold went to the greatest of all time. Simone Biles can now add a record 6th Olympic gold to her resume. Another American, Suni Lee, got the bronze. And swimmer Katie Ledecky made history by capturing silver in the 4x200 freestyle relay. That's Ledecky's 13th Olympic medal, making her the most decorated U.S. female Olympian ever. Looking at the overall medal count, and Team USA has solidified its lead with 37 medals, including gold medals today in swimming, rowing, and fencing events. Still to come on the NewsHour, we speak with voters about how the shakeups in the presidential race have shifted their views. Key conspirators of the 9/11 attacks now held at Guantanamo Bay are set to plead guilty. What's in the deal? And a new book on the international strongmen who work together to end democracies.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
An especially active fire season is exacting a huge toll across several western states. A series of fires have turned deadly in Colorado, where at least one person was found dead. In California, more than 5,800 personnel, 500 fire trucks, and 40 helicopters are battling a fire that's larger than all of Los Angeles. The Park Fire, as it's known, is the country's largest and has ballooned to historic proportions in just over a week. Stephanie Tsai has the latest.
This is the view for firefighters on the front lines of California's Park Fire. The blaze, believed to be started by a local man's burning car, is now the fifth largest in state history.
I have not personally seen a fire grow so fast in such a short amount of time.
In just a week, nearly 400,000 acres burned across four counties, forcing thousands of evacuations and destroying hundreds of structures. In rural Cohasset, California, Dave Tejon and his son Jonathan are both members of the county fire department. While they battled to protect their town, their own homes were lost to the flames.
I feel luckier than some of the people here because we do have a few things, not very much, but a few things to hold in our hands that survived. The friends from that I've known for so many years have just stepped up and shown so much support. You know, I feel rich in that.
Christy and Michael Deneau also live in Cohasset. They lost their house to another fast-moving fire 6 years ago in Paradise, California. Now, this is all that remains of the home where they rebuilt their lives. They had no fire insurance.
The most important things I grabbed was me and my brother and sister have my mom's ashes along with my dad. And so I was able to grab a few little pictures and her ashes.
The Park Fire's explosive expansion is nearly unprecedented, says UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain.
This is definitely a top-tier event in terms of how quickly it moved across the landscape in those initial days. Some of the fastest rates of spread over that initial 24 to 48-hour period that we've seen on a wildfire in this part of the world.
Nearly 100 fires are currently burning across the West, and 4.5 million acres have already burned this year, about a million above average. This week, multiple blazes broke out across Colorado's Front Range, killing at least one person and forcing residents to flee their homes near Denver. Governor Jared Polis has now activated the National Guard to assist with logistics. Meanwhile, in Oregon, crews are stretched thin, battling more than 30 separate fires.
I've lived here all my life and never, never seen it this way.
To make matters worse, another brutal heat wave is forecast to turn up the temperature this weekend. A dynamic that Swain says continues to drive the intensity of this year's fire season.
It has become a very active season, and a big part of the reason for this is that nearly the entire western half of the country, as well as the western half of Canada, have experienced, much like California has, record-breaking heat in recent weeks over a very long and sustained period. So all of that extra heat, even following what was a relatively wet winter in some places, has really dried out the vegetation, in some cases to near record dry levels.
And that means there's plenty of fuel for the fires yet to burn. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Former President Donald Trump is facing backlash for calling Vice President Kamala Harris's racial identity into question when he addressed a black journalists' convention yesterday. That says the vice president herself wrapped up a series of events aimed at speaking directly to black voters. Our Laura Barone-Lopez has more.
Delivering the eulogy before hundreds of mourners at Fallbrook Church in North Houston today, Vice President Kamala Harris bid farewell to a friend, the late Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, who served in Congress for nearly three decades and became one of its most influential black members.
To honor her memory, let us continue to fight to realize the promise of America, a promise of freedom, opportunity, and justice, not just for some, but for all.
Harris, remembering a fellow black woman trailblazer, as her own racial identity is being attacked by her rival, Donald Trump. Speaking to a historically black sorority yesterday, Harris slammed her opponent hours after the Republican nominee questioned her racial identity.
Donald Trump spoke at the annual meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists. And it was the same old show. The divisiveness and the disrespect. And let me just say, the American people deserve better.
Trump was asked if Harris, who is poised to be the first black and South Asian woman to become a presidential nominee, was a DEI or diversity hire, as some of his Republican allies have said.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
In spite of the backlash, Trump is digging in, posting this to his social media platform, thanking Harris for the, quote, nice picture that showed the love of your Indian heritage. And at a rally in Pennsylvania last night, the Trump campaign displayed news headlines that referred to her as an Indian American senator. The former president accused Harris of faking her identity.
In her speech in Atlanta last night, Kamala Harris even tried to outbrand a new Southern accent. Did you hear a new accent?
Harris is biracial, the daughter of an Indian mother and Jamaican father, and her black identity, a key part of her history as the member of a historically black sorority, while a student at a historically black college. Today, at the U.S. southern border, Trump's running mate tried to put the spotlight back on policy, namely immigration. Vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance toured an unfinished section of border fence in Arizona and blamed Harris for the Biden administration's border policies.
Has Kamala Harris done anything you've asked her to do? She is the border czar. Has your border czar done anything you've asked her to do? And the answer is no.
Harris, however, was never charged with overseeing border security. Instead, she was tasked with addressing root causes of migration and why people flee their countries of origin. And with 96 days till Election Day, the breakneck pace of campaigning for Harris and Trump is just beginning. The Trump campaign said today it raised nearly $140 million last month, trailing the $200 million Harris raised in the first week of her campaign. Harris could be the official Democratic nominee by Monday and will hold her first rally with her yet-to-be-named running mate next Tuesday in Philadelphia. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone-Lopez.
And for those voters who have not firmly decided which presidential candidate to support, the events of the last month, including an assassination attempt and a new Democratic candidate, have dramatically reshaped the race. Lisa Desjardins connected with the type of voters likely to decide the election before and after those shakeups.
We heard from thousands of voters across the country, different ages, politics, and walks of life, all dreading this election.
I'm wishing for something like normal.
I feel despondent. I feel that there is no good choice.
I just feel overall really disappointed and really hopeless.
We'll highlight a few now. In June, they were unhappy.
Frustrated, disappointed, let down.
A little dejected.
But just weeks later, extraordinary events changed the race. An assassination attempt raised a new image of Trump, followed shortly by a new partner in the race, with Trump choosing Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as his running mate. And just days later,
I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
Biden was out of the race. Vice President Kamala Harris was in. But what did all this mean for voters? From our deciders, we have a snapshot of the change. It was large for Anna Fernandez, a 22-year-old in Miami about to go to law school. Here's how she felt over a month ago.
I have not a lot of confidence that things are going the way that they should in this country, but trying to maintain hope.
But her feelings now?
Like, I feel joyful, excited, like, so hopeful, so excited.
Anna, who's finishing a gap year before law school, is herself an immigrant from Cuba. She crossed the border as a 4-year-old and sees her family as part of the American dream. But she also sees immigration policy that is failing both migrants and the border itself. A Democrat, she trusts Harris more than Trump to improve things. She has questions about Harris, but she's ready for a new generation and all the memes that Harris has sparked.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
She's definitely energizing me. Well, I love to think that I'm a serious consumer of news. I also love when Charlie XCX tweeted that Kamala is rat. Like, that made me very happy.
It was almost like a cloud had lifted.
In New Mexico, Carlin Pinkins has a sense of hope, too. But it may not help Harris. Pinkins is a graduate student and working multiple jobs. She has a full life, trivia nights, and getting outdoors. But rent is high, and she barely gets by. She believes both parties are failing people like her. She wants to vote third party, but in June was worried about that helping Trump. This was her then.
We have these two candidates that don't care about people in my situation. And I'm steadily year after year watching things for me and my friends and people in my community get worse.
And now?
I feel a lot better voting third party now that I know that the Democrats are putting up a candidate that has a good, really good chance, I think.
What about a group Trump especially needs? Unhappy and critical Republicans.
So a few things have happened since we last talked.
They have. It's been quite an experience here so far. I told you I wasn't too excited for this election cycle, and I guess that's probably been the most exciting one we've had in a while.
Zach Horn is a teacher in Western Pennsylvania, a family man and sports fan with two kids. He's highly tuned in to the election. In June, he was undecided.
Like, this is the first year where I'm just not as excited as I would have been in the past. So I think that's where that disappointment feature comes in.
But 3 weeks later, the assassination attempt, just an hour from his home, put Trump in a more human light for him.
It helped to make him more personable, I guess, is what you would say. So in a way, like in terms of the vote and things like that, it kind of moved me closer to a Trump vote.
He watched the Republican convention thinking perhaps Trump would be a unifier.
Thank you very much.
And for 25 minutes, Zach heard a candidate he could support. But then the speech and Zach's thoughts changed again.
It became a stump speech. And it was a lengthy stump speech of that. And that lost me, to be quite honest. I was going to say, I was kind of like, I was hoping for the call for unity. It didn't happen the way that I expected it to. And so that initial move closer kind of got washed with some of those things later.
Now he's looking at Harris, considering her seriously, and saying her VP decision could make the difference. Zach's experience with Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro has been good.
If Josh Shapiro gets selected as the VP, I'd probably go from a lean Trump position currently to a lean Harris position at that point. But I still want to hear what everybody has to say.
Another unsure Republican.
Like I said, if it was tomorrow, it would be there'd be a lot of prayer.
Steve Beck runs his own travel agency in Alabama. In June, he had mixed feelings.
On one hand, discouraged, but on the other hand, just encouraged because we have a process that has been around a while and it still does a very good job.
He remains disappointed, but he's trying to move past it, even as he still doesn't love the candidates or how they got here.
I wish, you know, Kamala Harris had gone through a process. I wish there was someone other than Trump, but this is where we're at. And it's up to me as a voter to continue to look deeper.
One more decider in a swing state. This was Georgia voter Lauren Capey in June.
Frustrating.
She felt neither Trump nor Biden listens to voters. And now, with Harris as a candidate?
I feel differently. I feel more positive. I feel like maybe she's more in touch than he is. You know, of course, she's younger and she's female.
Capey works for the Social Security Administration and finds joy in travel. And while she had been more anti-Trump before, she now sees reasons to like Harris.
Something feels different. I don't know, you know, what that is. But yeah, I'm a little more hopeful.
Something feels different. For voters, for the deciders especially, the race is not over. It's restarting. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
The man accused as the mastermind behind the September 11th terrorist attacks and his two accomplices have agreed to a plea deal in exchange for avoiding the death penalty. The development comes 16 years after their prosecution started. Ali Rogan has the latest.
The three men, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged leader behind the attacks, and Walid Mohammed Saleh Mubarak bin Attash, and Mustafa Ahmed Adam al-Hawsawi, all agreed to plead guilty in exchange for life sentences. The men have been in custody since 2003 and initially charged in 2008. But there have been years of legal delays due in part to the brutal torture the men were subjected to while in detention. In a letter, government prosecutors said they recognized the deal would be met with mixed reactions among thousands of family members who lost loved ones, but they called it the best path to finality and justice in this case. For a closer look, I'm joined by Wall Street Journal reporter Jess Braven. He's the author of The Terror Courts, an account of military trials at Guantanamo Bay. Jess, thank you so much for joining us. How did this deal come to be, and why is it happening now?
Well, this deal was under negotiation since 2022, and it wasn't the first time a deal like this was considered. For years, prosecutors and officials in the military commission apparatus thought that a deal for life sentences in exchange for guilty pleas was pleas would be the only way out. So an earlier effort was quashed by higher-ups in the Pentagon. This one began, as I said, in 2022 and has continued as some of the detainees, some of the defendants, KSM, as we've called him, and the other two decided they were ready to get some finality for their own fate and move forward. So it really accelerated in the last 2 weeks. There was a court session at Guantanamo Bay. Prosecutors and the defense attorney said they were ready to wrap it up and try to get this case closed.
Prosecutors had sought the death penalty, but the alleged torture that the defendants underwent for years complicated those proceedings. How did that all factor into this decision?
Well, it was really essential because, you know, right after 9/11, when reports began emerging about brutal treatment of enemy prisoners, torture, as in fact President Obama called it at one point, began to emerge, there were questions about how would this affect any future trials. And there were legal experts then who warned that it would make it very difficult, if not impossible, to prosecute people if they were severely mistreated by the government while in custody. And that is exactly what has happened. These detainees wanted to bring in evidence of how they were treated by the CIA. Mohammed had been waterboarded, they'd been beaten, all kinds of things had been done to them that the United States would not tolerate for its own citizens. And they wanted to bring in evidence saying that any statements they made were infected by torture. So a lot of the pretrial wrangling over more than a decade has been over what can the defendants introduce about their treatment. And then there was a second factor. which is that under a doctrine sometimes called unclean hands, the government is punished by courts when it commits misconduct in a trial. And abusing defendants in custody is misconduct. So it is possible that even if they were convicted and sentenced to death, on appeal, a higher court might sanction the government by taking the death penalty off the table. So the death penalty seemed to be really a bridge too far given the mistreatment of these prisoners after they were captured by the U.S.
And what do we know about how the families of 9/11 victims are responding to this?
It is a total mixed bag. There are thousands of families of victims, and as you would expect, there are opinions across the gamut. There are some who feel that nothing short of death is appropriate for these defendants, and you know, based on their actions, it would be hard to say if the death penalty is appropriate for anyone. It wouldn't be appropriate for them. Others simply oppose the death penalty. Many Americans and people around the world just philosophically or morally oppose the death penalty, period, for anybody, and some of those are among the victims' families. And then there are those who really take the prosecutor's point of view, which is that ideally they could pursue capital punishment for these defendants, but it's just time for closure and it's time to end this proceeding and move forward. One of the features of the deal is that there will be a sentencing hearing where the defendants can testify, but they will have to answer questions from the victims' families. And for many of those families who are looking for answers, who are looking for some sense of these accused perpetrators, that hearing will be the substitution for a full trial on what, about what happened in the lead up to 9/11.
In the moments we have left, what happens next? Where do these defendants spend their life sentences?
Well, again, it hasn't fully been approved by all the proceedings that have to happen, but the plan is that they will next enter a plea, probably within a week or a month of now. Next year, there'll be the sentencing hearing, and after their sentence is confirmed, they likely will spend it right where they are now, at Guantanamo Bay. The technical status of their detention will change. They'll be sentenced prisoners, but in terms of their day-to-day lives, probably not much will change. They will be looking at the same four walls that they are looking at right now for the rest of their lives.
Jess Braven, covering this every step of the way. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
Today's historic prisoner release from Russia was thanks to the diplomatic work of a group of democracies, freeing over a dozen people from the autocratic regime of Vladimir Putin. But as William Brangham reports, a new book examines how autocracies are gaining power and what they're doing with that power.
In her new book, Pulitzer Prize winner Anne Applebaum punctures the commonly held image of an isolated autocrat. Instead, she documents the often interconnected ways these strongmen rise to power, how they bolster each other, and then work in tandem to undermine democracy. The book is called Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World, and Anne Applebaum joins us now. Welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thank you.
Can we start with the definition? Because people throw out socialist, fascist, communist, often without knowing what those terms really mean. What is an autocrat, and who are the autocrats out there that we would know?
An autocrat is someone who seeks to rule with no checks and balances, with no checks on his authority, with no judges, no media, no intermediary figures or institutions, who wants to control everything that happens in the state and to make all of the decisions. And the autocrats who I'm most interested in are the ones who not only want to have that system at home, but who are interested in protecting people who want to create those systems abroad. So the book is mostly about Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, and a host of others, Zimbabwe, Azerbaijan. There's a list of them. And increasingly, they operate as a network. They seek to protect each other and also to disrupt the democratic world. And that's because the language of the democratic world, meaning rights, laws, rule of law, justice,
accountability,
transparency, those things are harmful to them. And of course, that's the language of their own internal oppositions. And so they need to undermine the people who use it. And if they can, discredited. And that's part of what we're seeing happen now around the world.
One of the stereotypes that you try to puncture here is this idea that they really don't have shared interests, that they work individually to oppress and terrorize their own citizens, but don't really care so much about what happens elsewhere. What is it that they do see as the value in helping, what does she see in helping Putin or Putin in North Korea, for instance?
Well, some of it is pragmatic. So Putin gets ammunition from North Korea, and he gets drones from Iran, and he gets components for his defense industry from Xi. And some of it is a little bit more than that. So Xi may have an interest in not seeing Putin fail, because if Putin fails, that speaks badly of autocratic systems. It speaks badly of the kinds of leaders who rule with absolute power. And it might have a negative impact on him. They worry a great deal about the autocratic club and the fate of its members.
Your book is dedicated to the optimists out there. And I wonder, when you look at how the West and NATO stood up to Putin's aggression in Ukraine, does that give you a sense of optimism that the forces of democracy can be marshaled against autocracy?
It really did. I mean, it was a moment nobody was really sure what would happen when Russia invaded Ukraine in the full-scale invasion in 2022. And the degree to which not just the old West, you know, Europe and America, and not just NATO, but the entire democratic world rallied. There's something like 50 countries who've participated in the defense of Ukraine or the aid of Ukraine. The flip side is that I don't think we fully understood at the beginning of the war the degree to which there was going to be an autocratic network that was going to support
supporting
Putin.
Him with yep. arms and money and all of those
arms
things.
And money and support of other kinds. And we need to now begin thinking about how to counter that. And people are beginning to think about it, but it, you know, a little like everything, a little late.
This is not a book about Donald Trump. I mean, he gets a few passing mentions and a good chunk of the last page of your book. But you do write that if he were reelected and uses the tools of executive power against his perceived enemies, that it would, quote, then it would be the blending of the autocratic and democratic worlds will be complete. Do you think that Donald Trump wants to be an autocrat?
He certainly says so. I mean, sometimes he says so in a kind of jokey way, I'll be dictator for one day. Sometimes he says so in the language he uses about whether it's about President Xi, who he admires, or President Putin, who he admires, or even the dictator of North Korea, who's, you know, driven his country into poverty and isolation, who he also admires. So he's telling us what kinds of people are on. He has very few kind words for American allies or for fellow democracies. It's really the absolute people with absolute power that he wants to be like. And you can also hear in the language he uses, whether it's about judges or whether it's about the media or whether it's about American institutions of other kind, about the electoral system, that he has great disdain for the institutions of democracy and the rules that were set up to make sure that power is checked in our country and that the executive isn't a king. And those are disturbing traits, and they would be, they would be disturbing at any time in history, but they're particularly disturbing now when we have the rise of so many leaders with absolute power around the world who would love to have a transactional American president to do deals with.
People who live in democracies love to think that when pressed, that the system will be robust and stand up to this. I mean, that was what many people thought of happened during the first Trump administration, that the system held. Do you think that that's naive?
It can be naive. I mean, there is a pattern, and you can see it with Viktor Orban, for example, of people who lose elections, people like Donald Trump, who believe they are owed power or they deserve power, who lose elections and who come back in a second term and say, right, this time I'm not going to make that mistake again, and who then change their electoral system, or in Orban's case, change the constitution, change the judicial system in order to make sure that they never lose. The attention that's paid, for example, to Project 2025, which is a project of the Heritage Foundation, which describes exactly how you would do that, and which sounds remarkably like what's happened in other countries, including, by the way, in Venezuela. That was how Hugo Chavez took over. This isn't necessarily a right-wing or a left-wing project. It's just an anti-democratic project. And the fact that he will be surrounded by people like that is disturbing.
The book is called Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. Anne Applebaum, great to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for joining us.